Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Greetings, fellow time travellers. Lovely to have you with me, as always, as we travel through space and time together. This is the series where we look to the past to see what lessons might be learned from the ancestors. Their experiences, their wisdom might give us a hand in coping with our own present-day circumstances. And goodness knows we need all the help we can get as we try and struggle our way towards a better future, or at least a future we can all survive. To help support what we do here and to get access to exclusive videos every week, sign up to my Patreon.com site if you would. Just go to Patreon.com, look for me by name, part with a bit of cash, and join the extended family. It's that financial support that makes everything else possible, and it would certainly be wonderful to see you all there. Okay, it's now time to strap into the time machine as we set off towards the next stop in my love letter to the world. Recorder, microphone, action. Strange bedfellows come together to change the world. The US military and a gang of Californian acid-dropping tech utopia dreamers. At 10:30 p.m. on the 29th of October 1969, the first message was sent by what became the Internet. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver and this is my love letter to the world.
Afternoon, Neil. In the last episode, it was 1969 when we left the Earth and set foot on another part of the universe. Where are we this week?
Hi, Paul. Hi, fellow time travellers. Well, it's still 1969. We've hardly moved in time. But yes, in last week's episode, we wished Mr. Gorsky good luck as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the surface of the moon. Open brackets. So they say. Close brackets. This week, our journey through history involves a short hop. It's just the 29th of October 1969, about 3 months after that first lunar landing. We're in California in the United States of America as Charlie Klein sends a message that will change the world. Hello, the time travellers. Well, it's hard to pin down this one. We're kind of everywhere and nowhere, baby. It's the internet. The advent of the internet, the technology that made it possible. I mean, we're in the United States of America, but as we all know, the internet by definition is a, you know, an interconnection of technology everywhere. Right at the very beginning of the of these love letters to the world, we considered Enheduanna, the first named poet, all the way back in Mesopotamia, in the distant depths of time 4,500 years ago. So we talked about Enheduanna and the significance of writing. And writing, as we all know, makes possible sharing information without speaking face to face. You know, if someone sends a letter, they take the thoughts out of their head, they make them into symbols on a piece of paper, and then they send them across a distance and you read them. And those ideas enter your head. Very clever. And of course, she's the first named poet, but as to who actually began writing for the very first time, we will never know. And it's certainly safe and fair to say that before and after Enheduanna, there were people writing. And before and after in Head Joanna, there were probably people that saw the potential of controlling information. You know, if it's you that's circulating the data, then you can influence people. You can take control of a situation in many ways. Hammurabi, who inscribed a set of rules, laws on a stone, a pillar of stone, so that anyone could go up and see his version of the law. And that would be an example of someone who wanted to dictate and thereby control information. You know, do as I say, do as I write, have written. And there's loads of examples, and we've touched on a few of them in the love letters. Chandragupta in India, and he had edicts carved on stones scattered throughout his demesne, his domain, his kingdom. He wanted to impart information. There's good grounds for thinking that there was something at least partly benevolent in what he had in mind, that he was trying to bring everyone together, you know, in that disparate, scattered, huge terrain with different faiths and understandings of the cosmology. He was trying to create something that would unify. And then, you know, if we fast forward to much nearer our old time, Gutenberg and the printing press, that changed everything forever. Before the printing press, the transformation of manuscript into something like a book, and then the production of copies of that book, was in the control of a handful of people, the literate for a start, and those who could afford to do it. It's very time consuming. It takes a lot of time to laboriously write out by hand an entirely new copy of a book. So it was possible within the church and in the hands of kings to be very controlling around information in that way. But when Gutenberg came up with movable type and a printing press of his design, meant that books could be mass produced for the very first time and information could rapidly circulate. And it had consequences, for example, for the Reformation. When Martin Luther put his 95 theses in manuscript in Latin on the church door in Wittenberg, it was because of the printing press, it was possible to take that and copy it and send out thousands of copies of it. So mass circulation of information. So there's been a long process of the development of the means by which information might be shared, how quickly and to how many people at any one time. And then after the printing press, the coming of the internet is the next big revolution that changes everything for everyone forever. We can pinpoint the first message. It happened at 10:30 p.m. on the 29th of October 1969. So a long time ago now, more than half a century. I was born in 1967. So when I was 2 years old, the first message was sent. For the sake of chronological context, it came 28 days after the first supersonic flight by Concorde. It was all happening in 1969. The message read, well, L-O, which sounds a bit like hello, but it was low, L-O, and it arrived on a computer screen at the Stanford Research Institute in Menlo Park in California. Low was short for, it's really law, I suppose. It's short for log in. And it was sent by a programmer called Charlie Klein from his computer, or the computer he was sitting at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, 350 miles distant from Stanford. And that goes down in the history books as the first message sent and received via what we know now as the internet. It was in its fledgling form at that point, but what it was the roots of the first green shoots of the growth that is the internet. When I was composing this love letter, it struck me again how often in the past, great developments have required two people working together, or the coming together of two entities at least. Gutenberg would not, well, let's say, might not ever have got the press, the printing press, built, if he hadn't had the funding that was made possible by his sometime business partner, Johann Fust, he underwrote the exercise. We also, in the past, have looked at Johannes Kepler and his work about understanding that the Earth moved around the Sun rather than the Sun moving around the Earth. And he wouldn't have been able to do what he did, or not at the time that he did it, but for the obsessive work that had been done by his sometime partner, Tycho Brahe. He had made all sorts of measurements, all sorts of observations of the movement of lights in the sky, and it was that work that Johannes Kepler was able to capitalise upon to do what he did. Karl Marx, he of the Communist Manifesto, he wouldn't have got that done without the help, and certainly not without the finance of his partner Friedrich Engels. Because Marx was penniless for most of his life. His wife famously said that their lives would have been a lot easier if Karl had spent more time earning capital than just writing about it. And some people say it was Engels that wrote the Communist Manifesto. Anyway, but the two names are synonymous, Marx and Engels. Orville and Wilbur Wright, the Wright brothers, they of the first powered flight. Orville flew the thing, but Wilbur had his hand on the wing and was his partner throughout, and was a steadying hand throughout. So there's this idea that sometimes people change the world on their own, but just as often it's partnerships. And the internet, what we have as the internet, depended upon, well, it's hard to imagine two more unlikely bedfellows in some respects, being the US military and a bunch of hippies, mostly in California, sandal-wearing, acid-dropping hippies. And it was their collaboration, unlikely or not, that gave birth to the internet. The military, I mean, it's all time after time after time through history, it's military that intrigue and plan and plot and think and, you know, trying to get things done. The military, in the thick of the Cold War, where the USA and the USSR were bumping heads, but not actually going to hot war. The US military feared that a sneaky nuclear attack by the Soviets might knock out the computer network, might knock out everything. And they wanted to find a means by which their computers would somehow stay connected if the worst happened, so that in the aftermath of that kind of strike, they could at least communicate across the continent, across the nation. And so they got in train with the hippies, and the hippies had their own reasons for wanting it. There were very few computers in 1969, certainly by the standards of today. And people who were computer programmers, fledgling computer programmers, they had to book out time and travel to where computers were, you know, so that they could do their computing. And so they wanted to find means by which they could maximize the potential of computers by linking them up, so that you weren't just working in isolation, but you could share information. And those, a lot of the, I'm calling them hippies, I'm just having some fun there. Those technologists, many of them were influenced by the counterculture of the 1960s. And there were dreams there of a technical utopia, where there would be everyone and anyone would have open access to networked computers, so that, you know, obviously the philosophy being that if many people were able to work simultaneously in concert, that the advances would be, you know, would be exponential. By orders of magnitude, things would improve. That was their, I suppose you would say, their naive hope for what might be made possible by sharing computer power. But they needed money. You know, they'd had the same dream, but they couldn't get it off the ground. But the money came from, well, in the first instance, the United States Defense Department, an organization within called the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network. And for that reason, because the money came from there, the first iteration of the internet was called ARPANET, ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, ARPANET. And internet as a term was coined later, and it's shorthand for internetworking, you know, descriptive of the way in which if you can bring all the computers together, you can all work together, you can network. And there's a long list of fascinating characters who each in their own way made significant contributions to what became the internet. One of them is an Englishman, Tim Berners-Lee, who in the late 1980s was working at CERN, you know, in Switzerland, the big donut under the ground where they fire particles at one another, you know, and they do all of that work that people fear will one day create a black hole and suck us all into oblivion. Well, he was working at CERN in the 1980s, and while he was there, he worked on and developed hypertext. Anyone who's dug into the scaffolding, the background of what actually makes the internet happen will have come across the term hypertext. And he didn't invent hypertext, but because it was there, it was an extant idea. But he made it something that people could use. And it's the means by which documents that are physically in computers all over the place, you know, sat on one hard drive, can be accessed by all the other computers in the network. So it sits in one place, right? So a copy of the Bible, let's say, sitting on the hard drive of a computer in a given location. But via hypertext, you can let every other computer in the network access the same document. So it's simultaneously there and everywhere. And it manifests in our experience in those highlighted blue words on a website page, so that you put your cursor over it and click on that, and it takes you somewhere else and opens up. That's hypertext. And I'm kind of doing him a disservice by saying that's making it sound as though that's all he did. But that, in short form, was the significant contribution. And what was even more amazing is that he gave it away. Having developed hypertext to that point, he just let the world have it at no cost. And that's what enabled the World Wide Web, you know, WWW. People often confuse World Wide Web and Internet, and they use the terms sort of interchangeably, which is a mistake. The Internet is everything. It's unimaginably vast. It's every bit of information, every image, every document, everything is the Internet. The World Wide Web is an incredibly thin sliver that everyone's got access to via the hypertext. All of the information that's available as those blue links, those blue hypertext links, that's the World Wide Web. But it's like an iceberg is, you know, 9/10 below the surface. Well, the internet is 999 gazillion parts under the surface. And there's this incredibly thin bit on the top giving people access to that information, which is generally the most desirable. But there's everything else besides that you just don't know is there. You can't access it unless you've got access beyond the World Wide Web. So that was Tim Berners-Lee. That's really what that changed everything for everyone. But the thing was, it was all very well to say it was the US military and DARPA and ARPA and the ARPANET, and it was idealistic computer programmers in some West Coast universities that made it all happen. But the truth, in many ways, the undoing of the internet was that it was a handful of technologically aware individuals, businessmen, really, who saw the way to billions of dollars and pounds and yuan and all of the rest of it. They were born and raised, as it were, in the free market economy thinking of the likes of Milton Friedman. And they were also influenced, many of them, by what's described as ethical egoism, which was the philosophy of novelist Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged and all of that, all of those works. And they were free market, libertarian, you know, anything and everything, legalize everything, leave it to the market, just put it out there and let the market tell you if it's valuable or not, all of that. That kind of thinking. They saw the golden goose, when they looked at the internet. This is what's going to make us. This time next year, Rodney will be billionaires. And so they were. There's a really good book, I've got it on the shelf up there, by an American thinker. He actually comes from a background in the music industry. It's called Jonathan Taplin. And he wrote a book called Move Fast and Break Things. And I can't remember now who put me onto it. I don't know, years ago, I think I read it when it was relatively new. I don't know how old it is. Move Fast and Break Things, which I believe is a form of words that Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook was fond of using. I don't know if he coined it or if he heard someone else say it. That was his philosophy. Move fast and break things. Be a disruptor kind of thing. And the book, because Jonathan Taplin had worked in the music industry. You know, he'd worked with the band and others, various songwriters from the 60s and 70s. And he had seen the way the music industry had been really kind of eviscerated, kind of gutted and filleted by the streaming platforms that evolved on the internet, so that people were just able to, for tuppence halfpenny, they could get access to all the music ever recorded. And it took all the money out of the music industry for creatives, like, you know, songwriters and other creatives. That pathway to making a living, if not getting wealthy, was just blocked off. And so Jonathan Taplin, coming from that background, wrote Move Fast and Break Things to explain to people the danger really inherent in the philosophy that was driving the internet by that time. And so the book, it's a great read for anyone interested in the background and the history of the internet. It talks about people like Peter Thiel, who was behind PayPal, which is the mechanism by which people, you know, buy things on that kind of electronic transaction. Bill Gates of Microsoft, he writes about. Sergey Brin and Larry Page, who are, here's another double act. They're the two names associated with Google, although more and more people nowadays think that all of these things were really the concepts of, or certainly adopted and driven by the CIA and the US military. Anyway, if they caught a glimpse of what looked like a potentially useful idea, they just jumped on it and then sort of propagated the idea that it was just crazy guys working out of their garages and back their mother's back bedrooms coming up with the like Microsoft and Facebook and Google, when in fact there's a lot of thinking that says these guys are just the front, the acceptable face of something that was being driven by the government and by the state. Anyway, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook's another one that Jonathan Taplin writes about. And it's all about how what had been conceived by the MIT long-haired, peace-loving guys as open access, sharing of information, making the world a better place, was overtaken by the ruthless pursuit of dominance and profit. It was ever thus. If you've investigated the internet at all, the name Doug Engelbart resonates instantly. Doug Engelbart was a visionary in the world of electronics, computing. Before there was the internet, there was Doug Engelbart. He was one of those that were there before it happened, who foreshadowed it, foresaw it. He was a prophet, really, of the internet. And in San Francisco, in December 1968, at a big event organised by the Association for Computing Machinery and the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, catchy name, catchy acronym, ACMIEEE. And so it was a big industry event. And Doug Engelbart, as his presentation, put on what's gone down in internet history as the mother of all demos, the mother of all demonstrations. He was able to demonstrate the potential of the internet that he could see in the future. So this is in the year before that first message, LO, was sent from Stanford to UCLA. The year before was the demo. And at that point, computers really, for even people that worked with computers, even people that designed and built computers, saw them primarily as tools for mathematics and arithmetical calculations. They were just tools for doing sums really, really quickly. But Engelbart demoed a prototype internet that he had cobbled together that's a bit pejorative, actually. It makes it sound a bit kind of cack-handed and amateurish. It was very, very clever, very, very slick by this, you know, for the time. He made it possible to show what could be done with the available electronics and computers. And essentially what he demoed at the mother of all demos was a means to navigate the internet. He showed you what could be done, how you could... He imagined this world and then showed you how you would move through it. In the book, Taplin actually describes what Engelbart had in mind, what he said he had in mind, which was to provide a tool for individual empowerment. The user could access the world's knowledge, create inspiring content, and share it with anyone. Now, that's very modern thinking. That chimes with how we understand the potential of the internet now, half a lifetime later. And Engelbart was thinking that and saying that then. So it's powerful stuff. It was inspirational stuff, you know, and that was 1968. Tim Berners-Lee, he had inherited the Engelbart philosophy, the Engelbart ethos, as is manifest in the way that he gave hypertext and the World Wide Web to the world for free. He was just making that open-hearted, big-souled contribution to the betterment of humankind. So that as recently as the 1990s, the dream for the internet was still open access, just an egalitarian utopia. But the internet is powerful, as we know, and 40-odd years ago, some people were very quick to identify that power. Everybody else was just kind of, you know, skipping through the daisies of it, thinking how wonderful it was. But other people were thinking, you know, this could be the ultimate source of control and power. And we see that writ large certainly in the advent of social media platforms, the behemoths like Facebook, and then Jack Dorsey's Twitter, as it was, now renamed X by its second owner, Elon Musk. And those entrepreneurs, they tapped what they rightly sensed was an insatiable human appetite to be seen. And to gain the approval, not just of people we know, but almost even more important, people we don't know. People want to reach out and make contact with and be seen and gain the approval, the little love heart likes of hundreds and then thousands and then millions of people. And somehow or other, way back then, a handful of individuals intuited that, understood that, could see it coming. And I can remember I was involved in the internet back in the early 90s. I was part of the team that developed BT.com, which was British Telecom's website. And I used to sit in on meetings. I was brought in as a journalist to look after content, but I was sitting in on big and contributing to meetings where the technologists were building the thing physically. And I used to kind of, to the point where it began to almost annoy people, I used to say, how can this be free? I was coming from a world of where if you wanted to have a phone in your house, you had to pay by the call, your phone bill. And if you wanted to have television, you know, you paid. Most people rented a television from Radio Rentals or something. A few people bought their televisions, but there was a cost involved. And I used to say, how can this be free? We're just giving people access to more and more information, millions and millions of pages as it was then, uncountable billions and trillions of pieces of information by now. But I was missing the truth of the matter, which is that it was only free at the point of delivery. It came at a cost that many people haven't even realised to this day. You hand over your private information. You hand over more information about yourself, consciously or unconsciously, deliberately or not, than has been gathered by any government ever. You know, the most ambitious government ever could not have dreamed of persuading people to hand over as much information about their secret self as people ended up doing willingly in return for videos of cats falling off of piano keyboards. That was all it took. Give people free stuff like that and they'll tell you everything. They'll tell you their mother's maiden name, their date of birth, your preferences about this, that and the other. It's really quite extraordinary. But the tech gurus tapped into that. And, you know, there's a couple of adages that are worth remembering. One of them is vanity trumps privacy. So in return for those likes, those hearts, those views of things you put out there, people are prepared to expose themselves completely. And in, by now, that means exactly what I say it means. You know, they will give of their naked flesh if they think it's going to attract attention. And the other adage is, if you're not paying for it, you're the product. That's probably the most important one. If you're not paying for it, you are the product. So every time we click the consent bit on a website just to get access to the information there, we're giving away all sorts of information about ourselves, our internet history, all the things we've ever bought, all the things we've ever searched for. It all goes out there and it all goes out to advertisers. People that want to sell us things get access to this information, which means that, you know, the advertising that appears on your screen is being composed in real time, instantaneously, based on the information you have inadvertently handed over. They see it and they go, oh, this person's looking at information about shoes. Let's sell them shoes. So all of that advertising that appears on your page, that appears while you're, the things that appear on the side of your screen, it's all being assembled in the moment based on the information that you have given away by your activity on that website. They're reading your mind in real time and pushing things at you. It's incredible. And the content that is out there, all of that vast bank of material has been harvested from the last 5,000 years, at least, of human endeavour. From Enheduanna and her poetry to now. That has been taken by the internet and given back to us as though it's new. But it's not. It's just giving us access to what it took 5,000 years of clever people to compile. A wise man said, we're living inside the corpse of a whale. There has been plenty to eat, but only because there was a whale. And that's very wise. You know, all of that stuff all that music we stream, all the books that we download, all of that information, Wikipedia, Encyclopedia Britannica, it's all there because other people over the centuries and over the millennia compiled that information, came to that understanding. The philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and the rest of them, that's the whale. And we're just consuming it. But already it's clear that even with all of that being available now, people are already cannibalizing themselves to make more free content. The audience is producing its own entertainment. And in the background, the people that own the platforms, the handful of people that own and control the platforms, just profit all the time from harvesting and then selling to advertisers more and more of our private data. And the advertisers are more than happy to consume that data and push stuff at us, and that's how that's what oils the wheels and makes the machine go round. And so, you know, against all the expectations, all the dreams, all the ambitions of those back there, that handful of dreamers in 1969, you know, the person that sent the message from UCLA and the people that received it and were so excited to receive the two letters LO, the people that read it at the Stanford Research Institute, they had dreams of it being this open, free, egalitarian place where we could all just do what we wanted and share and better ourselves and each other. Instead of which, the internet is a wholly owned fiefdom. It's owned by a handful. You probably get them in one room of mega rich people businessmen, corporates, the CEOs of a few corporations, and them in league with senior military and senior government figures. They own the internet, and increasingly they dictate every single thing that happens there. And, you know, the military were involved from the beginning, and thereby the state. And so maybe how it is now is how it was always planned to be. Tens of millions of unquiet ghosts swirling around the Gulag Archipelago. A network of prisons and labour camps. Reports, memoirs, letters, and the words by one brilliant writer lifting a corner of the Iron Curtain to let everyone see the reality behind. And contemplating a truth everyone should know, the line separating good and evil passes right through every human heart and through all human hearts. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new content every week, sign up to the Neil Oliver site on patreon.com. I'd love to see you there. I've got a new website address, easy for these complicated days. It's just neiloliver.com. I have a shop for series merchandise, t-shirts and mugs and hoodies. My Instagram account is Neil Oliver Love Letter. And my YouTube channel is simply called The Neil Oliver Channel, and it features new films every week. To help build this podcast, tell your friends about it, get them listening, and maybe write a review to convince the online crowd that they should join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Catnip Inc. Music is composed by Milo McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance is by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Squared Studios and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. podcasts production.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.